You know the facts. Michael Brown was 18 years old when Ferguson police shot and killed him. The teenager's death gave birth to the Black Lives Matter movement, which demands Americans stop government-sanctioned violence against black people. Now, this is one of the most significant events in recent U.S. history. It really defines a generation of all Americans, black, white, Hispanic, Asian. But you probably only had one view of this story. From the outside, looking in, through the lens of national media, you know, quick TV reports and newspaper articles. And this is significant because for some people, what happened in 2014 was a riot, whereas for others, it was an uprising. Most people just don't know the real story. The view from the eyes of people who were there marching, sweating, dodging rubber bullets. Sabaya Folayan is changing that. She wrote and directed Whose Streets. Her film premieres tonight on PBS at 10. It aims to show a different perspective on what happened in Ferguson, a different view of the start of the Black Lives Matter movement. Sabaya is here she's really trying to just make sure the voices of people who were on the ground yelling enough is enough, that their voice is still being heard. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what steps did you take to make sure your documentary was actually different from all the other accounts of what happened in Ferguson?
Yeah, one of the first things that I did when I touched down in Ferguson with my director of cinematography, Lucas Alvarado Farrar, is we looked for a collaborator who was born and raised in that community. And that's how we met Damon Davis, my co-director, very well-respected visual artist, very well-known in the community and already active in organizing. Together, we decided to tell a story that was going to be a people's history, that was going to honor and reflect the people on the ground with dignity and, you know, really be a celebration of what St. Louis is.
Saba, you used a certain technique that's really critical that enables your documentary to have really a unique perspective. What was the technique you used in terms of footage?
Well, we gathered footage from many, many different sources. We got there about a month after Mike Brown was killed, and we began shooting from that point on. But everything you see before that is gathered from live streamers, people on social media, as well as local journalists. And we felt like we could sort of replicate what people were seeing on the ground by using the media that they were producing at that time. The same thing goes for the tweets that you see used throughout the film. So our goal was to really create a piece that would be sort of a time capsule for what this moment felt like if you were standing in the middle of it.
What percentage of the footage do you think is actually shot by the protesters versus what you shot when you arrived?
That's hard to say because we shot hundreds of hours of footage that, you know, didn't make the cut. But I think I would say probably about 20% of it, probably a third of what you see in the first, like, half of the movie is collected. And then the rest of it really relies on the things that we filmed ourselves.
So why did you go to Ferguson in the first place? I mean, you're bright, you had a nice life, Ivy League educated, young woman of color. Why take yourself from that point of privilege and security to do this, to go right into what many people thought was a mad scene, to put yourself in danger?
Well, it was a bit personal and a bit professional. I was working in the nonprofit sector and I found myself frustrated because I felt like my ideas didn't really have the room to be expressed from the confines of a sort of entry-level nonprofit job. And I wanted to find a way to work on my own. My background had been pre-med and I had been studying trauma. So I wanted to go actually do a public health study to see the trauma that would play out in this community as a result of this conflict. And when we got there, it was just clear that you couldn't do that kind of clinical research, or I couldn't, in those circumstances. And that's how we organically started to film and ask questions.
And yet you're trained to look at those things. Were there any insights that your training in trauma actually picked up?
Well, it was really exactly what I expected. People, I think, who lived through the worst of that are still experiencing symptoms of PTSD, have suffered the mental health impacts of this situation, and it's something that my co-director and I are trying to work within the community to try to provide some resources and help folks with healing. But also on a longer scale, I think it's worth observing what's going to play out? How are the relationships in this community going to shift, both in the police and in civilians? What are the long-term impacts of this? Because the level of conflict, the level of artillery, the level of chemical weapons, you don't inflict that on a citizen population and expect there not to be long-term ramifications.
You spoke with so many people. You didn't plan to stay there as long as you did. Is that right?
No, not necessarily. The first time we went, we were doing sort of voting drives and food drives and trying to do community service and help and see what we could learn. But after the first interview that we got, we realized that there was an untold story here, that people were not being taken seriously, that with all the resources that were being poured into covering this, no one was really stopping to get the full picture. A lot of folks talk about objectivity, but it seemed like to us, the objective side was taking at face value public officials and police departments who were essentially investigating themselves.
Who were essentially investigating themselves, and you take a different approach. What were you most surprised by?
I was most surprised, honestly, by the lack of critical engagement on behalf of the media. And I'll give an example. It was the day of Ferguson, October, and I was speaking to the police chief. I had sort of inserted myself into the gaggle of press, and I was asking him.
The gaggle.
give me journalist. But I was asking him, you know, about something that had happened the night before when police had been banging their batons against their shields in this rhythmic way at this protest. And, you know, it was intimidating for the protesters there. So he was saying how all the police wanted was for everyone to be safe and express themselves. And I asked what was the meaning of that tactic. And his response was that the police just wanted to have their voices heard, too. And so I wondered, what was the message that police were trying to send? And he begins to spin his answer and avoid really responding to that question. And before I could sort of get an answer from him, another reporter interjected and asked, do you think these protests are going to affect the baseball game?
And the baseball game.
Right. And it was this kind of complacency and this kind of willingness to sort of let these people in positions of power off the hook with these very vague sort of non-responses that I found extremely frustrating.
You were raised in South Central Los Angeles, and I remember back in the day it was sort of a very, very tough place. Times are changing now. Did you ever have run-ins with the police yourself?
Not personally. I was sort of that kid that wasn't really allowed to go outside too much, although I was raised in the hood on 41st and Figueroa. My mom had a sort of different vision for me, and she did really intentionally shelter me from a lot of that. But, you know, everyone who I've ever dated has been stopped, has been bullied, has been beaten up. It's such a commonplace story that I think about if I ever were to want to start a family, like how could I even responsibly do that in this country?
Your mother took such pains to insulate you, to protect you, to keep you inside. And there you go. You went right into to this. But you've also been, you know, interviewing folks in Rikers Island as well. How does that research inform what you do today?
That has really been foundational to my understanding, because what I realized speaking to folks at Rikers, the one moment forever sticks in my head. I was talking to a 17-year-old kid, and I'm trying to talk him through doing this goal-setting worksheet. And he looks at me and he says, I'm 17, and I'm looking at 15 and a half years in prison. How am I supposed to set goals? And I couldn't answer that question. I couldn't tell this child how he was supposed to conceive of, you know, spending almost as long as he'd been alive incarcerated, and, you know, the things that had happened to him in his life as a child, as a vulnerable person, were so unjust and so unfair. And there had been no kind of justice for him. Nothing restorative had happened. No one had come to punish the people who had done him wrong. But yet here I was, supposedly trying to convince this kid that he needed to accept and take responsibility for his actions and try to envision a life, you know, sort of in a cage for as long as he'd been on this earth already. It just fundamentally did not sit right with me, and it really struck me in that moment how deeply our society has failed its children and how these problems just continue to multiply and grow, and how sort of arbitrarily we decide that, okay, this is justice and this is right and this is wrong. it's not inclusive. It doesn't take into account history. It doesn't take into account trauma. And so now I move much more holistically, and I'm always trying to think about how can we conceive of a future that is really responsive to people's lived experiences.
Does that story still haunt you, Saba?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As long as children are in cages in this country, as long as we see that as a solution, I'm not going to be able to rest. And I feel like it's my responsibility to use whatever resources are at my disposal to try to come up with something different.
Do you think your documentary can help convince people about these concerns to view them as legitimate?
I think, and I hope, that for Black folks and for people who are oppressed and for people who understand how it feels when you are supposed to be a citizen, but there is no higher power, no Justice Department, no police department, no mayor's office, no one to stand on your behalf, and you're left with no choice to stand for yourself and your community as a civilian. I hope that those people see that this is legitimate, that what they're experiencing is real, that the people who represent this movement are not just looters, not just rioters, not crazy people, just mad. They're mothers and fathers and teachers and nurses and very, very smart people and people with a lot at stake who are making sacrifices for all of our future.
And they're not just Black.
No, they're not.
I mean, that's sort of a popular misconception, but when you go there on the ground and you see the diversity of people who are out there yelling, chanting Black Lives Matter, it makes you think that this is much deeper than just the protection of Black lives, which is critical, but it's a symbolic of something greater. What is that greater?
Absolutely. This is about the evolution of humanity. This is about reconstructing the way that we define what is a valuable person, the way that we define what is peace, what is order, what is law, what is right, what is wrong. All of that has been based up to this point on a racial hierarchy. And throughout the world, anywhere you go, dark-skinned people are suffering the worst. And so this is not about civil rights. It's not about voting. It's not about, you know, how you are engaging necessarily in the political process. This is about fundamentally reimagining the way that we conceive of ourselves and the way that we conceive of power.
So, but what new forms of community have formed in Ferguson since that day? I understand that your documentary really looks into that as well.
Absolutely. People have sort of organized into cadres, different people having different focuses and you know, different sort of affinities, but they continue to be very active in local politics. People continue to be very active in sort of creating alternative solutions, being their own solutions. The Books and Breakfast program has been really popular, something adopted from the Panthers. People are just active in this network that was built. You know, there's this group of people there now that really shares this permanent bond. And one thing that I'll add, too, is that this moment was such a spark globally that everywhere I've been with this film, across the United States and abroad, and, you know, dozens of different countries, people were connected by this moment. People were woken up by this moment. And that's a network and an intangible sort of social connection that is going to continue to have ripple effects.
What about Cop Watch? I mean, I understand that people are taking things into their own hands. That can be threatening to established government, to local government. How do you negotiate that?
I mean, people have had their backs pushed up against the wall. And at this point, if an established government is threatened by someone, you know, exercising their basic rights, is threatened by being watched as they do their job, I think that raises much more of a question of what is the established government going to do to improve their relationship with citizens.
So to be clear, when we talk about Cop Watch, we're talking about a movement there where people are recording the police officers as they're going about their jobs. Is that right?
Right, correct. And my thinking is that if you are truly protecting and serving, then you should be proud and comfortable to be filmed doing your job in service of the community.
So as you know, your film is going to debut tonight on PBS. What do you want people to take away? What is the angle that we have not seen anywhere else?
There are several things. The first is just I want people to be reminded of the beauty and the dignity with which Black people do and have always upheld the values that this country claims and has not yet stepped into. I also want people to understand the level of artillery that local governments are wielding against civilians is really a threat to the concept of democracy. When protest can be met with that much weaponry, we have moved past, you know, the sort of ideal of free speech and what America means into something that is very, very repressive and very, very similar to the types of things that we're judgmental about when we see them taking place in other countries.
We have to wrap up this interview, but you are one of these latchkey kids who grows up, and there are a lot of kids like you. Would you encourage them to get involved, given the amount of fear that's out there?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think fear, it's a protection, but it also can be a signal that you're going towards growth. We naturally fear change as a survival mechanism, but you do things anyway. You carry the fear with you and you do it anyway. And I hope that anyone who sees this movie and is feeling like, you know, what do they need to do? Just apply your skills to the problem.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Saba Folayan talk about her documentary, Whose Streets? It airs tonight at 10 on PBS POV and POV.org.